This is Andrew Cate.
And this is Ryan Capuano.
And welcome to another edition of the Death of Cinema podcast. In this week's episode, Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe team up for an old sea yarn in The Lighthouse, while Eddie Murphy fucks up some motherfuckers in Dolomite Is My Name. But we're going to start things off with Robert Eggers' The Lighthouse. For those of you that don't know the name, Robert Eggers is the director of The Witch from a few years back, which I know some mainstream audiences could not really fully appreciate, but safe to say we definitely did, for sure. And I think everyone, even some of the people I talked to, at least they appreciated the third act craziness and wildness for sure. But safe to say, this is another Robert Eggers film that where he completely transports you to a different place in time, and he does it here again, literally boxing us in with the aspect ratio, having it in black and white, filming in Nova Scotia, triple he's doing all these different things that completely transport you away. And safe to say, it worked, because I saw this on Halloween, and it was definitely the best Halloween screening I had. Although there were some contenders later on in the night. But, you know, I decided to just rip because I think Ryan's always so good at doing the synopsis, and I never feel too confident in this. So I did literally ripped off IMDb, and I'm just going to read what they had for the synopsis, because I think it just sums it up perfectly. The hypnotic and hallucinatory tale of two lighthouse keepers on a remote, mysterious New England island in the 1890s. And I think that sort of perfectly sums it up. This is literally a two-hander between Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe. As you don't know, of course, that just means, you know, we have essentially two characters we're following. They're the only two actors for the most part. There's one slight appearance by another actor, but I won't say anything more about that. But it's basically just Pattinson and Dafoe going at it for nearly 2 hours, and I loved every second of it. I just really enjoyed it, you know, from the cinematography, the simple ways they sort of signify sort of impending doom. I don't know, it was just like two really great performances. And I've been watching, you know, as I always do, because, you know, I'm a fanatic, I watch a lot of the interviews with these actors sort of leading up to it, and mostly it's been Willem Dafoe, as I know Robert Pattinson doesn't always put himself out there, and I can't blame him, because he's always sort of just going for it and doing all these different crazy things. But Willem Dafoe, just to give some backstory on this, Willem Dafoe went and saw The Witch. He knew nothing about it, you know. He went and saw it in the theater, and then he was like, oh man, this is something. And he said the next day he just took his wife to see it again, because he was completely blown away. And then he's like, I'm setting up a meeting with this guy, he's onto something. And so Willem Dafoe set up a meeting with Robert Eggers, and they tried to make a few different things, and eventually they landed on this. And the thing about it is, I'm like, I can't imagine a more perfect actor to play an old sea captain than Willem Dafoe. He's doing all the classic, you know, sort of piratey type of dialogue. Sometimes it's not always completely, you know, sometimes you really have to focus and listen in to make sure you're getting the gist of it. But that's sort of the fun of the movie. And I think all the important stuff you get. And that's really the important thing. But he really is going at it. And then maybe someone who's even going at it even more so is Robert Pattinson, sort of playing this, so essentially the setup is, you know, Willem Dafoe has been this, you know, lighthouse keeper for a while, you know, at this remote island. And then Robert Pattinson is sort of the new recruit. And he's sort of getting to know Willem Dafoe. Willem Dafoe has his ways of doing things, just say the least. He's trying to get Robert Pattinson to drink, but that's not part of the rule book, as Pattinson sort of talks about. But safe to say, a lot of the sequences are just, them just sort of, like I said, literally going at it, arguing about random things, and eventually, of course, it leads to big drunken arguments that are just really incredibly entertaining. And it's a credit to the two central performances that we follow throughout, you know. And I love how, you know, the film is definitely dark for sure, and more ways than one for sure, but I love the way the darkness gives way to comedy at a lot of times, like the drunken argument over whether Willem Dafoe's character's cooking is good or not. There's just some really funny lines, and I loved that some of the people in my audience, I was an older couple mostly, that they really laughed hard at some of these lines, and I thought it really worked nicely, and it was a nice way to cut the tension, but also just add to the overall, you know, experience. You know, I mentioned some of the visuals that signify impending doom. I love the use of the seagulls. You know, it feels like it's such a classic thing to do, you know, for this lighthouse. I'm an ocean lover. I love just, you know, there's nothing greater to me than, you know, driving past an ocean, looking out, you know, on the tide. And I think this is one of those things that just has this atmosphere that is just inherent in it. The Witch had, you know, a great atmosphere, and this has a unique atmosphere, you know, all its own. But safe to say, Robert Eggers is certainly two for two, and this is easily one of my favorite films of the year, for sure.
Robert Eggers is a very interesting view of New England folklore, and my God, is it just an absolute joy to watch. This is a movie that was so much fun to just like kind of dig yourself and sink into. You mentioned, so I guess I'll start with it, you know, a lot of people have kind of complained, as they did about The Witch, about the dialogue sometimes being almost inaudible, or, you know, it's just kind of a mumbled mess, and that's obviously by design. That's not a fault of the sound mix or anything, but I feel that, you know, having to pay attention that much more actually drew me in a little bit better. And I want to talk about the sound design a little bit, because it's just like, it's all these, like, it's this very experiential film. You mentioned the aspect ratio. It's actually even smaller than the old Academy ratio. I think it's like 1.19:1, if I'm not mistaken, which is very, very claustrophobic. That's, you know, that's even like skinnier than the old, you know, tube TVs that we used to have back in the day. But the sound design is working against the audience in this film, which I absolutely love. Obviously, the score is quite good, but there are just so, like, so many diegetic sounds, you know, coming from within the lighthouse itself, that giant blaring horn from the lighthouse that comes up every once in a while, that you can't tell if it's actually a part of the score, or if it's just in the characters' minds, or if it's what the hell is going on. And it just uses all this against you, and all the dialogue is trying to keep you on your toes. Like Willem Dafoe towards the end says, you know, how long have we been here? Has it been 5 weeks? Has it been 2 days? Help me recollect. I mean, like, this movie is just like pure insanity from the get-go. And, you know, like, right from the first frame that you're in good hands, just by the way it starts with that, you know, that slow crawl, and, like, you're not really sure, is the frame, like, kind of moving? Is that, like, a film flicker, even though this was shot on the Arri Alexa? And then the boat kind of comes into view, you see the waves breaking, and then there's, like, a good 10-second shot of Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson just staring at the screen before anything happens. And it's just, like, it's just all these disquieting moves that Eggers uses so, so well to draw you into this insanity. And you mentioned the humor in this. I actually, like, this is a genre-defying movie, and I know that we're going to have another genre-defying movie coming up next week, but this is something that, I mean, it's not a horror film, it's not a psychological thriller, it's not a drama, and it's definitely not a straight comedy, but it does all of those elements incredibly well, and it throws them at you in such rat-a-tat fashion, and in even sometimes even in the same scene, that it just absolutely blows your mind. And as you said, the two actors in this film just absolutely go for it and go at each other. There are so many moments where Willem Dafoe has these great soliloquies where he's just like kind of rambling on and telling tales, and you're not really sure what the point of it is or where it's going. And he's using all this old kind of old timey, like, ah, yee, ah, and all the sea shanty stuff. And it's just like so magnetizing and hypnotizing to watch. And Robert Pattinson's freakouts towards the end of the movie are just absolute pure joy to watch, especially when he's at his wit's end. And there's that great scene that everyone keeps on talking about where it's about 3/4 of the way through the film and they're coming up on the end of their stint on this island, and they just get completely pissed drunk, and it's just Robert Pattinson just like completely losing his mind, trying to sing this song but losing the words and still going for it and just getting progressively more erratic. And then they show the two of them slow dancing, and it's just, there's so many interesting, I mean, the movie is a descent into madness in the first place. And it really just like kind of delves into those characters, and it doesn't give you a concrete answer of what the hell is going on, but you really do feel that sense of loss of sanity. And there's a lot of, you know, sexual overtones throughout the course of the film. There's a lot of homoeroticism, and there's also, and there's another bit with a, you mentioned the third actor that kind of shows up here and there. I don't want to go into spoilers with that, but it just, it's really interesting how it kind of, you know, there are these sexual undertones to everything that's going on, and there are just random sequences like of the actors masturbating. Robert Pattinson catches Willem Dafoe kind of like dry humping his bed at one point. And there's just so many scenes, like, and, you know, obviously there's kind of like the MacGuffin of the light in the lighthouse itself, and it's locked off, and Willem Dafoe doesn't want Robert Pattinson up there, so Robert Pattinson kind of like sneaks up and follows him one night, and then he just sees Willem Dafoe like masturbating, and then the semen pours down through the grates. And it's like, this movie is just pure insanity, and I don't even know what the film is trying to say about sexuality. Or, like, you know, that kind of the isolation that can cause that kind of erratic behavior, or those erratic fantasies, or erratic, whichever you prefer. But this movie is just like an absolute tour de force. I love The Witch. I thought The Witch was one of the scariest things I have ever seen, just because, I don't know, witches kind of get to me more than any other kind of supernatural thing. This film is not scary, and it didn't scare me, but I just had like that, much like, you know, I had Mother or Guadagnino's Suspiria, I just had the goofiest grin on my face just watching this madness play out in front of me.
Definitely, and I completely, you know, agree on pretty much all the points you made. But it's interesting you mentioned, you know, the Pattinson masturbating scene. I'm pretty sure they've talked about, you know, another one of these things I picked up on in these interviews. I'm pretty sure that was the first thing Pattinson sort of filmed. I think he talked about that, and he's just like, Robert Eggers is like, all right, we got it. I mean, he's just like, well, he's definitely going for it, so we've got it, and we're going to go for it. But yeah, I just think the two actors are just so fantastic. And like you put it, I was going to mention the same thing. It really literally is a descent into madness for sure. And I think it's just really a great setting for a film. Like, I literally had a thought like a number of years back, and I wrote it down. I'm one of these people who, you know, of course, an aspiring writer, so I write down random thoughts on my phone. And one of the thoughts I wrote down, like, I think 5 years ago or something, was like, do for lighthouses what Jaws did for the ocean. I was like, damn it. And I was like, damn it, I think he did it. And, you know, I like you say, it doesn't exactly fall into one specific genre, but I do put it in that sort of, you know, the art house horror movement of recent, where the films aren't always necessarily completely, you know, horror, you know, in that way. But I think this still works as horror, even though it may not be horror in that traditional sense. And I think that's a common thread across a lot of these recent art house sort of horror films in general. But there's just a distinct mood and atmosphere to this film. You know, I love the use of the lighthouse and some of the other elements that, like we allude to, we're not going to spoil too many things here, but there's some elements in there that really work. But I just love the way the film, you know, plays with, you know, your reality, as you've sort of talked about, you know, a bit, where you don't know necessarily at certain points what is real, you know, what isn't. They set up early on that, oh, maybe he's just dreaming or having a nightmare in this way, but then later on it doesn't exactly seem that way, to say the least. So you don't, and I love the way the film is, it's pretty unpredictable, even though we just have these two characters going back and forth. And I love the way it's handled, where they're arguing in one scene, drunkenly arguing, and then the next scene they're like, they're okay with each other, and they're having real in-depth conversations, you know, about their past. And that's something that comes up with Robert Pattinson's character's past that sort of plays a big role later on, you know, in the narrative. But I just think, you know, two absolutely fantastic performances. You know, Robert Eggers, like I said, is clearly two for two at this point, and I can't wait to see what he does next, because we know it's going to be something unique for sure.
Lest you forget, it's going to be Nosferatu.
I did forget about that, and then as soon as I said that, I took my mouth away from the mic. I'm like, oh crap, why did I even say that? I know what he's going to do. And yeah, I'm really pumped, you know, about that for sure. He said he's a big fan of F.W. Murnau's original, and also the Werner Herzog version, which is literally probably my top five favorite films, you know, of all time, you know. But he said he's sort of going to skew more towards, you know, the original, which I think makes sense given his particular style. So yeah, I'm insanely pumped for that as a big Nosferatu fan. So yeah, I can't wait for sure.
Yeah, that's got to be my most anticipated movie of my miserable shit life. But and it's just that one last point I want to touch on is, you know, we talked a little bit about the aspect ratio, but the cinematography itself is just like so haunting and hypnotic, the way it plays with shadows and the framing of characters and the way they're blocked in scenes. And it's just like the way that almost like the camera movements demonstrate the dynamic of power being shifted from one character to the next, or from Seagull to Robert Pattinson. It's just like really weird how that kind of plays out. And obviously, even from just like a pure aesthetic standpoint, it's beautiful to look at. It's hard to fuck up that kind of like chiaroscuro black and white cinematography, but they really nail it here. This is a movie that's very, very hard for a lot of mainstream sensibilities. This is a movie that demands a lot, but I really hope that the Academy, and I know, like, who gives a shit what the Academy thinks at this point? I'm 33 years old. I'm past the point of that in my life and pretending that the Oscars actually matter. But if I had a vote, I feel like Robert Pattinson, Willem Dafoe, Robert Eggers, cinematography, the sound work, sound editing, sound mixing, all of it, that production design, what the hell, go for it. This is it. Film editing, original score, throw it all in there. This is one of the year's best.
Definitely, and I feel like a lot of people have been talking about Willem Dafoe in particular, but I think both of them are just equally, you know, incredible. So it'd be great for both of them, you know, to get, the right appreciation that they clearly wholly deserve. And I understand this is definitely not something that's gonna be, you know, for everyone, but it seems I think this one is connecting more, you know, with, you know, a slightly more mainstream audience than The Witch, which is kind of insane to say. But I'm happy about it. I'm not gonna hate on it. it. So definitely, obviously, this gets the highest recommendation, you know, from both of us. And I think, you know, I mentioned, you know, the art house horror movie, and I just wanted to mention briefly, you know, sort of this is something in recent years. And obviously, there's always been, you know, horror films, particularly, you know, in a lot of the foreign markets, you know, with a lot of, you know, Asian filmmakers who have really, you know, embraced it, you know, throughout the years. And very recently, it's come over, seemingly over to North America with filmmakers like Robert Eggers, with filmmakers like Ari Aster, who we talked about, you know, Midsommar, and of course, you know, the great Hereditary, for sure. And, you know, I think a lot of this harkens back. There's a lot of other great stuff out there. A lot of it harkens back. There's other things like even David Robert Mitchell's It Follows, which, you know, I think, you know, is one of the sort of at least, you know, first ones that sort of broke through in that way. And then sort of all these others, you know, followed instead or whatever. And these really unique voices really came out. And I think it's just so great. And a lot of people, you know, have pointed this out throughout time, Matt. I think horror is one of those genres when it's done and handled with care so well, it's one of the most absolutely satisfying genres. And I don't just say that, you know, as a horror hound. You know, I love, you know, basic slashers, and I think we had a lot of fun with Happy Death Day, you know, and stuff like that. So I think a lot of the mainstream stuff is fun as well. But what's great about horror is it always goes through these different phases, and there's so many different things it can tackle. And I think it's just really great and heartening that we've gotten, you know, a lot of great stuff in recent years, for sure.
Absolutely, and I'll throw in Jennifer Kent's The Babadook into that as well, which kind of got the ball... you're right. I guess It Follows, The Babadook are kind of in that... The Witch all kind of came out in that same area of time, and I you know, even, like I briefly mentioned, Luca Guadagnino's take on Suspiria, which I didn't get to see initially when we did it on the podcast, but I did catch up with him recently for Halloween, and it's just, like, it's... You're right. The way that horror kind of plays with our innate fears and just digs into them, you know, whether that's just, you know, the fear of someone, you know, being behind you, or when you're trying to do a ghost watch or something like that, or even when, you know, Happy Death Day and Happy Death Day to You, even though that was more of a sci-fi thing. But when you really get into that, you know, that primal fear, whether that's, you know, the relationship that you're in, or the grief of losing a loved one, or the black goat on your farm, or any of that stuff, it just, the way it just, like, it digs in. And you're right, when they use those filmmaking tools against you and against the audience, and really just, like, want you to feel as uncomfortable as humanly possible, and it gives you that resolution of insanity at the end that you feel is the only logical explanation for what it is that you're feeling, that there's something to be said for that. And, you know, obviously I will always have a place in my heart. And I, obviously my track record for my favorite movies of the year usually do show that I go for more the character-driven, small indie comedy dramas, dramedies, what have you, such as Florida Project, Lady Bird. But, you know, at the end of the day, this is, you know, horror is special. And I really am just happy to see that, you know, Oni Baba is one of my favorite horror movies of all time. I haven't seen it in a while. But the fact that that style of filmmaking is, or that attention to detail and care with horror is finally coming onto Western sensibilities is just, and, you know, maybe it's just our generation, but I'm super happy about it all the same.
Yeah, and I think literally my top four of the year at this point are all films that, you know, at least three of them are, I would say, are mostly in the horror genre, and one of them sort of definitely has elements of it for sure. So I think it's really intriguing that, you know, I definitely, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see, you know, obviously this is the best time of year, you know, for film these next few months. So we're going to be seeing, like, literally we're stacked, as you'll hear, you know, as we're going to be seeing lots of great stuff, you know, in the coming weeks. So it's just a really exciting time, and it's great that we get to see these genre pictures sort of elevated in this way. And before we move on to, you know, Dolemite, we're just going to briefly touch on, you know, a news story that's been making the rounds over the past, you know, couple weeks, which involves Netflix, of course, as always. And, you know, we're going to be getting to a Netflix film in a little bit, but, you know, Netflix, you know, there was recently a rumor, and nothing has been substantiated or specifically, you know, confirmed, I guess, at this point, but there's this rumor going around that was reported that, you know, Netflix might be adding an increased playback speed of 1.5, you know, times the speed. And look, I understand in the modern times we live in, and we're always very, you know, open-minded to a lot of things, but as people who respect the work of filmmakers and stuff, I don't think people realize how much a slap in the face this is to filmmakers who are creating specific experiences for an audience, you know. And some people who don't necessarily see it from that perspective are just like, oh, why shouldn't we be able to watch something at, you know, at a quicker pace? pace, and I don't think people realize that it's completely changing the experience that a filmmaker or a showrunner on a TV show has specifically crafted for you, and rightly so. You know, a lot of filmmakers, I think Judd Apatow was the biggest sort of name that sort of jumped out there and sort of like, well, you're not going to be able to attract, you know, a lot of filmmakers, you know, in this degree. And then there's even a larger discussion. BoJack Horseman creator Raphael Bob Waksberg recently came out, you know, and was talking about it literally earlier today or in the last day or so, was talking about how, you know, the changing business model of Netflix is kind of sad, where a lot of these smaller shows, which are really great, you know, and got a great showing initially, aren't necessarily having the same platform. And that can lead to sort of a larger discussion, but this increased playback speed is just ridiculous.
To anyone who, and you know, Netflix said that that this is one of their most suggested features. To anyone who suggested this, go fuck yourself, please. This is just absolutely insane. I can't imagine like watching, like, all right, just using some of the movies we just talked about. Can you imagine watching something like The Witch at 1.5 times speed? It's jarring enough watching Seinfeld on TBS when its speed is jacked up. I don't know. Fuck you. Go, like, the no. Just watch the goddamn movie. That's the same thing as the pan and scan argument when DVDs had their halcyon days and we were, you know, full screen versus widescreen and all that shit. Just watch the movie the way it was made and be happy that you have something to latch on to. Spend 2 hours of your life and calm down for a goddamn minute. And if you want to calm down really, really, in a really, really fun way, you can't do much worse than Craig Brewer's Dolomite Is My Name. Holy shit, what a fun movie this is. For those of you who don't know, I kind of went through a phase when I was like 18, 19 years old where I watched a lot of blaxploitation movies. Somehow the Dolomite series kind of slipped away from me for some reason. I don't know why. I was really big into Melvin Van Peebles back in the day too. And I guess to that end, Dolomite Is My Name, the biggest thing that I can think of, the biggest point of comparison would be Mario Van Peebles' Badass, which came out in 2004, which was about the making of his father's film, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, which is just, you know, just pure 70s. Blaxploitation fun. I don't know if anyone's ever seen Blackula. That's a whole other discussion. That movie's just a pure joy too. But basically this tells the story of Rudy Roy Moore, and I did watch the original Dolomite a couple weeks ago, completely pissed drunk and just laughed my ass off, had a blast. Rudy Roy Moore was a basically an aspiring stand-up comedian slash lounge act back in the 70s. Who was, you know, was just like trying to find his place. And it's just really interesting watching him rise through the ranks of putting together a comedy album that he records in his own apartment to basically putting together this $30,000 production that he pretty much pulls out of his ass, using his friends to help him film it, his friends help him act in it and direct it. And, you know, honestly, it's just that pure Eddie Murphy energy. I've had a lot of reservations about this guy, both, you know, as a career choices and some personal issues with a lot of the material he did as a stand-up back in the 80s. But Titus Burgess is in this film, so I'm going to take that as kind of a peace offering and just move on from there and never speak of that again. There's just such an energy and pulse to this film that is just every single scene is just so much goddamn fun. And the cast is so incredible. I mean, Mike Epps is in this, Craig Robinson, I mentioned Titus Burgess, Snoop Dogg is in it, T.I. has a fun cameo, Chris Rock is in this too, Wesley Snipes, my God, Wesley Snipes stars, and I'm blanking on the actor's name, but it is a gentleman who eventually went on to direct it. You forget how sneaky good actor Wesley Snipes can be sometimes. I recently watched Tu Wong Fu, Thanks for Everything, Julie Newmar, and that was a movie I was not allowed to watch as a child for whatever reason, even though I was allowed to watch Face Off and Con Air, but I digress. It's just like he has like this kind of weird doe-eyed queerness to him that just like kind of shines through, and he has, my God, I can't even explain it. It's just something you got to watch. But at the end of the day, this is really Eddie Murphy's show, and the way he inhabits Rudy Roy Moore in that energy, it just feels like it's doing a great service to him. It does have that tone of, you know, it's balanced. This is a pure comedy, but it does kind of balance that, you know, that like it's dramatic, but it's also like kind of fun and just like thrilling in a way. And you know, just watching the recreation of some of these scenes is just absolutely hilarious. And then that kind of has like a nice little denouement at the end where we go into the end credits and we're actually seeing the old scenes from these movies, and it ends on just like the pitch perfect note before going into the final credits. If you're a fan of movies about movies and how movies get made, I really do think that this is just going to be an absolute blast for you. It's really an underdog story, and it has an absolute dynamite performance from Eddie Murphy. The costumes are a shitload of fun. I mean, I can't really say anything else about this.
Yeah, it's just a really consistently funny, really endearing portrait of a man who's literally willing to do anything to be successful. And yeah, Eddie Murphy is just clearly just having a complete blast, you know, in this role. And it's just great to see him, you know, in that mode. Because he's had his certainly fair share of critical acclaim, you know, over the years with certain roles popping up here and there. But I don't know, I can't recall, you know, a recent role of his that he really was going for it, you know, in this way and just having so much fun on the screen. And I think that really translates, you know, through the screen and just helps you, the audience, you know, have fun as well. You know, you mentioned Wesley Snipes, who is one of my favorite, you know, parts of this film for sure. And I believe, you know, he's playing this character, Derville, I believe is his name. And essentially he's you could call him the pretentious director of Dolomite, who essentially views himself as sort of a bit too good of an actor to be sort of in this. I love that introductory scene in the strip club where he's just like talking to this lady and just sort of dismissing Eddie Murphy and his crew or whatever, and then all it takes is like he could direct, and then he's instantly interested. He's like, oh, I haven't got that opportunity before. And he's talking about how, you know, on when I worked on Rosemary's Baby, John Cassavetes, you know, and all talking all this stuff or whatever. And I just love the way Wesley Snipes plays his role. It's such a specific way to play the role, and it was just perfect. You know, he's not like necessarily like has the biggest role, you know, in this film, but it's just, it's perfect for what it is. And I even love his exit scene. just every note sort of his character ends a scene on is just pitch perfect, and I really, really loved it. I also, one of my favorite scenes, you know, Keegan-Michael Key also pops up as the writer of the film, Jerry. And one of my, probably my favorite scene in the film is the scene where Rudy is pitching ideas to him, you know, for the movie, and he's just pitching all this ridiculous stuff like kung fu, exorcism, and it just gets across the point that Rudy Ray Moore loves everything. He's like, oh yeah, black people love all this stuff, and it was just so great, and it's just so endearing and such a joy to watch. And also, I think the interesting thing about the film is it sort of works as a tribute to the filmmaking process, you know, as well, which is interesting because when I went on IMDb and saw the writers of the film, I'm like, oh, it all makes sense now, because the writers of this film, Scott Alexander and Larry Kazowski, or whatever, however you say it, they were also the writers behind such films as Ed Wood, the best Tim Burton film, Man on the Moon, of course, the Andy Kaufman biopic. And while this film, I wouldn't say necessarily goes as in depth, you know, or has the depth of some of those other films in the way, or the, I guess, the emotional core of those films, I think it's just such a blast, you don't really care, and you're just enjoying and go with it, and just really enjoying the great performances. And safe to say, I'm really pumped for Craig Brewer's future collaboration with Eddie Murphy and Wesley Snipes when he's making the sequel. It's called Coming to America, but the two this time is literally the number, so I couldn't be more excited for that as well.
You know, I'm trying to fit, you know, and this is something that we kind of talked about before we even started recording, that, you know, we're saying this movie doesn't have a hell of a lot to it, but it is a lot of fun. I'm wondering if that's because as white people, literally everything is for us, if that makes sense. But this is a film that, you know, and this is something that the movie goes out of its way to point out. They even go to the, whatever that Billy Wilder movie they saw with Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau, that, and they're just sitting there shit talking like, what the fuck are we watching? And they really showed, and Rudy Ray Moore keeps on talking throughout the course of the film. We're making this movie for black audiences. We're making it for that 10 blocks of the city that no one else will go to. This is a movie for us and by us. And that's really, I guess, the heart of the movie. And I feel stupid for that not dawning on me earlier, but when you just said that, that just kind of clicked in my head. I guess, you know, come from that perspective of privilege. When I say literally everything is for us, literally every single movie ever released, it doesn't matter if it's by, you know, Paul Feig or Alfonso Cuarón. It's just like, I feel that I have a home at every single film that I see, regardless of, you know, the cultural standing of that. But, you know, maybe that's just, you know, my natural empathy. But for something to truly be for an audience is really the ultimate testament to Moore's greatness. And I, you know, you say greatness, I mean, screenwriting, acting, maybe not necessarily his forte from a pure technical standpoint, but as this is something that I've been pointing out ad nauseum over the course of this past year, that it doesn't matter. This you cannot tell an artist how they can use their paintbrush, essentially. And, you know, it doesn't matter if it's rough, quote unquote, rough around the edges. This is a pure passion project, and it's a shitload of fun. Speaking of the original Dolomite film, it's a shitload of fun to watch. And for a black audience in the 70s, that was not necessarily being catered to at all, aside from a small section of films that later became known as blaxploitation. You know, we had like Sidney Poitier in The Heat of the Night, and, you know, some other smaller, you know, there were very few prominent African-American roles. But to finally see this like movement of cinema must have been really something special to witness as a black person in that time period. But as a white person 40 years after the fact, and seeing it saying it's a time capsule is almost dismissive in a way, but just seeing it as like a cultural moment that often gets overlooked is, it's just, you know, as a film buff, it's a shitload of fun. And, you know, honestly, it's just really, it's galvanizing to watch in a way.
Definitely, for sure. And I love the way you pointed out that scene where they go to the movies. I thought that was such a great, you know, sequence and sort of send up of typical, you know, tropes in that way, where they're just like watching this movie and all the white people are just laughing their asses off about this film. Yeah, with Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau and stuff. And I was like, yeah, I'd never heard that movie before, you know, in my life. And obviously I know the actors and stuff, so that was really intriguing. But I love the way they're like, oh, let's go see this before. And then they go see the movie, you cut to them in the movie, and they're just like, what the hell? I don't understand this at all. And I loved how, you know, you really feel Rudy's drive throughout. Like I said, he's really driven to be successful at anything. And then I love that sort of subsequent scene when they get outside the theater and he's just looking at the poster and he's like, oh, we gotta make a movie. I deserve to be, you know, on the big screen. And I love the way they deal with that as well, because there's even a sequence where when they're on set, and I believe, you know, they bring on, you know, sort of the white college kids or the crew, and some of the characters are sort of dismissive, and then Rudy's like, oh, that's racist, what are you talking about, or whatever. And I just loved his perspective on things, where he's just like driven to be successful. It doesn't matter what it takes or what it matters. And there's also a lot of fun in the sequences. Like I said, I love Wesley Snipes in this. I love the sequence where Rudy's like has this like fight sequence or whatever, and Wesley Snipes is like, oh, they're talking about like, is there any way we can make that kick like realistic? And they're just like, no, there's no angle that could possibly do that. But yeah, it's just a complete blast, just really fun, and I couldn't recommend it more highly. You know, it's currently streaming on Netflix, so definitely check this out. And this is the best time of year, because all this stuff, whether it's award season or just pure fun, you know, you can just really enjoy a lot of this stuff. And, you know, we'll be getting to more of these films, you know, in recent times as well. But with that in mind, we can turn our attention to next week, where we're going to be reviewing Bong Joon-ho's latest masterwork, Parasite, which I saw earlier today, and good God, I cannot wait to talk about this. For those of you that don't know, I'm a Korean filmmaker, you know, Bong Joon-ho, who has been making, you know, great films, you know, for well over a decade now, from things like Memories of Murder and The Host, to more recent sort of English language fare like Snowpiercer and Okja, which he made for Netflix as well. And this is something else. Another one, as Ryan alluded to earlier, that sort of defies genre classification. Man, I can't wait to hear Ryan's thoughts after checking this film out. And we're also going to be checking out another film currently streaming on Netflix, which is David Michaud's The King, starring Timothée Chalamet, Joel Edgerton, as well as Robert Pattinson, once again giving another wild performance from everything, you know, I've heard about. And I can't wait to check this out, and not just for, you know, these random listicles online talking about the bad haircuts. You know, we can talk about a film in a different way, people. I'm not saying we can't have fun with some of these elements, but come on, let's enjoy the film. Come on.
Are you telling me Timothée Chalamet is not a dead ringer for Mark Zuckerberg in that movie? Just give me a break. We were initially going to do Edward Norton's Motherless Brooklyn, but it's 2.5 hours long, and people say it's tepid at best. And, you know, even from the trailer, something about Edward Norton just, you know, doing his Tourette stick for so long. And I got threads in my head. And I didn't, no, fuck off. I'm not watching that shit. You go watch it. But, you know, as always, we thank you so much for humoring us through this little project, and we'll see you next week.